Inner Voice, a heartfelt chat with Dr. Fujian.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Inner Voice Show. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain, and I have Sean in studio. This is a show about what matters most in your life, our mind, our thoughts, feelings, actions, relationships, and our fulfillment in this beautiful journey of life. In this show, I'll bring you the latest research in how brains work in syncing and they get in sync during music therapy. Then I will speak to Beal Pratzman, composer, musician, and the author of More Than Human, The Value of Cultivating the Human Spirit in Your Organization. And then with Michelle Tomlinson, an accomplished actor and the casting director of the groundbreaking podcast Frijoles y Arroz, and the author of Growing Up May, which is a children's book. You can call us on the studio line, 951-922-3532. Be sure to listen to my podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and share it with your friends. Go ahead and put reviews on it and tell people, tell other people if you like it to come on along and listen to us. We'll be right back with the tip of the week and the research.
Hello, I'm Dr. Fujian, and I have great news for you. I'm offering a special time-limited offer to anyone who's interested in online therapy or coaching sessions. I've developed the awareness integration model, which allows in only 12 weeks to raise your self-esteem and confidence and let go of your thoughts and emotions that produce depression and anxiety for you. So call today to schedule your online session and save $600. Call me today at 818-648-2140. That's 818-648-2140. Or go to www.fujian.com.
So this is the tip of the week. This is this week. I've been working on the issue of what is my passion? And when do I get there? Many people choose their career, but what it is right there in front of them as the ideal career, or what their parents or society says that it should be the right career, or what the economy dictates to be fruitful careers, or they just go from job to job and try to find their career. There are also people who are set with their career. However, they're constantly reaching and striving for more and more growth and wanting to reach the place that they could finally say they are a success. The clarity of the vision and the goal is very important. It is crucial to know what the tangible result will look like when they call themselves a success. The path will unfold as time goes by and by trial an error or role modeling after already successful people. However, there is also the matter of the internal state of being and how we go through the path. Many times we look to find our passion out there in the world with what is available, and it just doesn't register for us. We keep thinking, what is my passion? Let me look at this and let me look at that. And it just does like, oh, I'm not interested in this, is not my passion. And that's how we look. There's another way, which is look inside. Your passion is inside of you. Observe what makes you smile and creates shine in your eyes whenever you're doing the task or thinking about it. Observe to see what your thoughts gravitate toward when you're not busy. Usually that is what your passion is. Then you can see how to monetize it. Doing what you love and enjoying it is the greatest asset that you can have when you do what you enjoy and see how you can create a career out of it. You will flourish. Then just do what you love, and people who are there to find you will find you. And as long as you offer great service, loving what you do, you will inevitably be successful in feeling and in a tangible way. Be courageous and find who you are and offer what you are naturally to the world. Everyone will benefit from that. Today, because we have a couple of guests, I'm going to go really quick through all of the research too. Okay, so I found this research latest. It just came out 4 days ago. In Science Daily, that's where I found it. So for the first time, researchers have been able to demonstrate that the brains of a patient and a therapist become synchronized during a music therapy session, a breakthrough that could improve future interactions between patients and therapists. The research published in the journal Frontiers in Psychology was carried out in Anglia, Ruskin University. This is the first music therapy study to use a procedure called hyperscanning, which records activity in two brains at the same time, allowing researchers to better understand how people interact with each other. During the session documented in the study, classical music was played as the patient discussed a serious illness in her family. Both patient and therapist wore EEG, INSIP, I can't even say that word. You know what I mean. Those caps. Containing sensors, which captures electrical signals in the brain. And the session was recorded in sync with the EEG using video cameras. Music therapists work toward moments of change where they make a meaningful connection with their patient. At one point during this study, the patient's brain activity shifted suddenly from displaying deep negative feelings to a positive peak. Moments later, as the therapist realized the session was working, her scan displayed similar results in subsequent interviews. Both identified that as a moment when they felt the therapy was really working, the researchers examined activity in the brain's right and left frontal lobes, where negative and positive emotions are processed, respectively. By analyzing hyperscanning data alongside video footage and this transcript of the session, the researchers were able to demonstrate that brain synchronizations occur and also show that what a patient therapist's moment of change looks like inside the brain. Study is a milestone in music therapy research. Music therapists report experiencing emotional changes and connections during therapy, and we've been able to confirm this using data from the brain. Music used therapeutically can improve well-being and treat conditions including anxiety, depression, autism, and dementia. Music therapists have had to rely on the patient's response to judge whether this is working. But by using hyperscanning, we can see exactly what is happening in the patient's brain. Hyperscanning can show the tiny, otherwise imperceptible changes that take place during therapy. By highlighting the precise points where sessions have worked best, it could be particularly useful when treating patients for whom verbal communication is challenging. Our findings could also help to better understand emotional processing in other therapeutic interactions. That is awesome. For me as a therapist, to know those moments that really work and people sync together is the most amazing time of not only connection, but definitely healing for the client. And I could say even for the therapist, we get healed also when we work for you, I promise you. So now I'm also excited to have someone that we're going to talk about this with. Bill Pratzman is a man on a mission to raise awareness of the power of music as self-care. In addition to being a successful IT entrepreneur, Bill holds magna cum laude degrees in piano performance and creative writing and has concertized and performed for many years with a focus on bringing music to audiences in non-traditional ways. In 2011, he launched Music Care, Inc., a for-profit corporation dedicated to teaching practical ways music can be useful for self-care. His work was recognized by the National Council of Behavioral Health with an award of excellence in 2014. In the behavioral health world, that's the equivalent of the winning the Oscar. So when he talks about music and self-care, he speaks with gentle conviction from the real, real experience. So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with Bill Pratzman.
Hello, I'm Dr. Fujian, and I have great news for you. I'm offering a special time-limited offer to anyone who's interested in online therapy or coaching sessions. I've developed the awareness integration model, which allows in only 12 weeks to raise your self-esteem and confidence and let go of your thoughts and emotions that produce depression and anxiety for you. So call today to schedule your online session and save $600. Call me today at 818-648-2140. That's 818-648-2140. Or go to www.fujian.com.
Join the conversation every Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific for Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Dr. Fujian is a radio and TV host, international speaker, psychotherapist, life coach, and the author of Life Reset, The Awareness Path to Create the Life You Want. She brings you the latest research and interviews with experts in the field of cognitive sciences. Anyone who loves to grow and create growth for humanity gets a voice on this call-in show. Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Monday afternoons at 3 p.m. Pacific on Smart Talk KMET 1490 AM and on KMET1490AM.com.
I love this music. Welcome back to the Inner Voice Show. I am Dr. Fujian Zain, and I have Bill Pratzman with us. Welcome to the show.
Good, doctor, good afternoon. And very great to be here. Thank you.
How are you doing?
Really good. And you know, it's the Southern California thing we've been having. We finally got our summer, right? And I know people around the rest of the country are just sweltering in the rest of the world now, but hey, we've caught up. We're with you guys.
Yeah. Music here first. Let's talk about that. Music here is the use of specific music, music that you love, to produce a desired emotional, mental, or even physical result. The results could be calming after a stressful day or firing you up at a ball game. Let's talk about that. What got you to want to do this? Create music care.
You know, I've been a piano player all my life, and I've noticed the effect that it has on me, as well as the effect it has on people listening. And it's bigger than just playing the piano, because this effect of music happens to everybody. We can't help it. We're human resonators for sound and rhythm. So I got curious, and long story short, it saved my life. I mean, thanks to the power of being able to express what we think of as harmful emotions in a safe way, I do what I do, because, you know, I love classical music, and it's big and full of all this craziness. That's emotional tension is just, it's so rich in classical music. But that's been minding me. My ability to make those emotions, express those emotions in a useful way, has been there for me all my life. And I've only just recently, with the research that's coming out in the last 10 years and my own process of therapy, I've discovered that there's actual evidence that supports this thing that we musicians have known all along. Like your the research you shared about how brains entrain. Well, if you've ever improvised with anybody, you know that happens, right? And it's just part of being a musician. That's part of what we do, right? So
yes,
it's so cool that there's science behind that now.
Yeah.
And
Bill, I remember in my teenage years, I used to wake up pissy, like literally pissy. Yeah. Like, you couldn't talk to me for another 3 hours after I woke up. So I remember when I got to my first job, and I started working for 17, and I'm like, okay, I'm sorry, you can't go to work pissy. That's just not a possibility. So then I started putting music, like happy music, on. And within 10 minutes, I was like, dancing and moving around and really happy to go to work. And then another time I decided, you know, I want to exercise, and mornings are not a good time to exercise for me. And it's like, no, you got to do this. So I started putting the alarm with this kind of like techno type of music that you're really pump up,
yeah,
you know, and that by itself made convincing myself to get up and go to exercise is so much easier. So it's like, I think that everyone who's listening or watching us can go back and really relate in how they have really utilized music in their life in the way that it was good for them, or that it motivated them, or that it pushed them to the next level. And what is it that you particularly do in the music here? How do you bring that into the public, or bring it into people who go to music care?
Well, it starts with awareness, Doctor. I think the thing that's so cool is your own awareness and your story of how you found that this music changed your morning. And music can do that, but we have to bring our attention to it. We can't just let it ride in the background. If we focus in on it, it becomes a present, a purposeful tool that we can use, as you did, for intervention, to change your mood. Or, as I was talking about, I use it to sort of sustain my mood. If I'm playing a big piece of classical music, I've got to be in that emotion for a while. And music just allows us to do that in safety. So we can either intervene and go from like stressed out to happy, or we can allow ourselves the process of, say, sadness. You know, if somebody passes on and you grieve that process, it's music can help you through that. It won't speed it up for you, but it can certainly help you become more aware of how fully our emotions are embodied in us. You know, the adrenaline pop from anger or fear, fantastic, right? But if you practice music that gives you that adrenaline pop, you'll find it's much easier to come up with that extra boost of energy when you want it. Mm. And if you practice the process of grief, of course, lots of us wind up holding in our grief way too long. But if you practice that process of grief, it becomes a very natural thing for the sadness to come through you. And same with joy, of course. We all love joy. That's a fun one.
Oh, yeah, definitely. So you, at this point, what you do is be, you're the founder of Music Care. You're an author, and I definitely want to talk about your book. And you're also composing. Where can people find you?
Oh, it's really easy to find my music. I had the privilege of being an MP3, whatever it was, star back in the day. It was number one for about a week with an Amazing Grace arrangement that I wrote. But whatever that is, I'm easy to find. Bill Protzman on Spotify or even Google or iTunes, I'm out there. And I've had the opportunity, Doctor, this is so cool. I've had the opportunity to work with remote musicians. So in one case, I put down piano tracks and I shipped that over to a woman who plays Tibetan bowls in Texas. And
she I
put
love
down
the them.
Tibetan bowl tracks. And then we shipped it all over to a guy who plays wooden flutes and he put flutes on the top of that. And it's this wonderful, amazing collaboration. So thank heavens for technology. We can do that now, right?
We want to have it. Sean and I want to have it. So we could, if you give us permission, we'll actually even use it in our segments going from one segment to another. We'd love to have that. Yes, absolutely.
Now tell
me about your book. What got you, first of all, to want to write this book? Your book is called More Than Human. And as I was kind of skimming through it, and I didn't have a chance to read it all, but to just skimming through it, you talk about everything. I love it. You talk about politics, economy, everything, the human potential, everything that is out there. And I'm like, that is cool. So let's talk about your book, More Than Human.
So when you play music, there is this dimension to music that is neither physical nor mental nor emotional. And for whatever reason, I just called that spiritual. So it's the stuff that doesn't fit into the other buckets. And that's a very important part of who we are as human beings. All that other stuff, the stuff that is not physical and not mental and not emotional. There's something more there. Okay, so I thought at one point, hey, there must be a practical way to approach that. What would that way be? And of course, because the universe does this, I was working with some veterans at the time volunteering, and our little committee was tasked with figuring out how to address a moral injury. So moral injury is what happens when a soldier who has to go out and hurt things and kill people winds up coming back and realizing that that conflicts with what they believe, you know? So there, this very real trauma that exists and tension between what you believe and what you have to do is a spiritual conflict.
Yes, it is.
For whatever reason, we call it spiritual. So whatever that means, it's not religious. It's actually like moral, internal to you. Call it what you like. But practically, there are ways of dealing with that. It turns out that if you do things like be nice, show appreciation, you know, you mentioned some of these in your introduction. These qualities, these attributes of who we are as human beings really are best practices of practical spirituality. Well, nobody'd written the book, so I thought, well, why not? We'll write the book. And it doesn't have to be very long. And as you say, it covers everything, right? Because there are aspects of practical spirituality that can affect all aspects of our life. And conversation with a patient or with your family or in business, it turns out in business, practical spirituality gives your business a boost. People who are in businesses that are demonstrating practical spirituality have a happier place to work, and other businesses want to work with them. And it's just one of those things that's attractive, this practical spirituality. So now we have a little book that explains how and why, and that's what More Than Human is all about.
And as you were talking about this, I realized that it's interesting where in my practice and among my friends, many times when we talk about some of the businesses, immediately they will have this reaction of, no, they're not good to their employees, or you know how they're using a third world country for doing such and such, or you know they don't care, they look at humanity as commodity and who cares, that's the way they created, like who cares. And then they also talk about all of the beautiful companies who are giving back to community, giving back to the third world countries, or giving back to their own employees as, you know, a profit sharing, or just being kind, you know, being inappropriate. And it's like, okay, you could do your job. You just don't have to be a jerk about it. You can always be a great person about it. You know, jobs will go forward, tasks will go forward. And, you know, if you could be that person, it would be great. So a sample of, and I know people have these different ideas about what spirituality is, but then like you put this in a very simple concept in page 43. You said a sample list of spiritual best practices are appreciation, discretion, resilience. And I'm like listening, I'm reading this for all of our audience and listeners who are doing, it's like, this is how simple this virtue is. If you can uphold these virtues, as Bill, you know, shares it with us, appreciation, discretion, resiliency, integrity, equity, having a dialogue with someone, collaborating with people, having dignity, respect, which we don't have anymore apparently in the world in our communication. Yeah. Loyalty, authenticity, mentoring, courage, compromise, kindness, humility, and empathy. And you know, you could go on with some of this list, and definitely a sample list of the spiritual worst practices that yeah. you know takes people down, like cruelty, you know, unkindness, incompetence, disloyalty, disrespect, neglect, and rigidity. And then you go on, you know, giving us a list of that. And so part of what I hear you talking about spirituality is more about there are certain virtues, there are certain values that we could take as human beings and uphold them in who we are with ourselves and who we are with people around us. And obviously that would also be in our work environment, since we, you know, each one of us works about 8 to 10 hours a day and in the organization. Did you write this book particularly for the business world, or is it more like something that it's geared toward just anyone as a self-help book to read?
You know, it is one of those Amazon bestsellers, and it's an interesting question, because on its day of the launch, we hit number one in the business categories and some international business categories, as well as the spirituality categories. And I didn't really intend it to be that way, but I think your observation is apt, Doctor. It is a book that's bigger than just an organizational book, even though when I wrote it, I was part of a volunteer organization. I think it does cross over. I mean, it could work in families, and it could work in a conversation with just two people. We just light up in a different way when we're approached with spiritual values, practical spiritual practice, you know, things that allow us to be vulnerable in a way, with safety. You know, you've got a boss coming at you and breathing fire, that's not going to work. In fact, I just saw a study, I should send this to you later. I just saw a study today about how things in business are trending more toward organizations that practice mindfulness and appreciation. And there's actual studies. I have a PhD friend who's doing her doctoral dissertation on gratitude. And it's like, okay, we've done it the other way for a long, long time. And here's where we are now, right today. Take a look around. You know, we haven't been really using best spiritual practices in general for a long time. So how are we going to move forward? Mm-hmm. What's the way forward? Well, I think it's in that, you know, emotional intelligence and servant leadership. These guys are touching on the right notes. And so is the little book, More Than Human. It's touching on the notes. So let's make spirituality practical. Let's take it out of the realm of the unknown and start being human in ways that we're meant to be, that really work.
There's also this part that, as you were speaking, which I use a lot also in my own therapy when I work with couples, which is, you know, people utilize, Bill, different types of skills. at work, because they figure, okay, these are professional conduct that I need to have. And in order to have my business grow, if I, in order to have my customer come back, in order to have, you know, my boss not fire me, and all of that, I have to utilize these values. But then when I come to my neighbor or come to my spouse or my children or my family members, suddenly it's like, oh, don't worry about it. This is personal. Then I can just, you know, be the nasty person that I want to be. And that's okay. And usually a lot of times I'm like, you couldn't behave this way and be successful at what you do if you actually did this out there with, you know, other people. And they're like, no, I would never do that. Why? Because I know I'll lose my customer. I'm like, well, duh, you're going to lose your, you know, mate. You're going to lose your children at one point. You're going to lose your neighbors and friends. So it's more of, yes, it's interesting that we see the price directly, immediately, when it is with organizations and businesses and all of that. And therefore, because the consequence and the impact is so severe right there, that we learn pretty fast in what's appropriate and what isn't.
Yes.
And some of these virtues of it that you're talking about are so important to uphold as a human being across the board of who we are. And can you talk a little bit about that in the concept of, you know, holding these values to cultivate the human spirit in businesses? But isn't it like we're losing human spirit in our society? We're losing it in our families. We're losing it in other places. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yes. So I've kind of lived that. In the book, I talk about how I became aware that IBM wasn't my home professionally. Now, that's a great organization with huge, like multi-year respect for everything that they do. And yet it wasn't for me. Well, it's not that our values didn't line up. It's just that I was practicing in a different way. You know, whatever my upbringing, family of origin, you name it, I had a set of values that worked very well for me, but just didn't fit in within IBM. Both great values. Nothing wrong with either set, right? So being courageous and being able to say, hey, this is a great environment here at IBM, but it isn't quite right for me, and I need to go this other direction. Wow. If the entire world were able to make choices like that, what a different place we'd be. But instead, we find ourselves making choices like, you know, I really hate my boss. I'm going to find another job. Well, that might be a good choice. I have no problem with that. But why do you have to hate your boss? Is your boss so terrible that he deserves hatred? Or is it you that has this built-in anger thing and you just have to unleash it on somebody and your bosses? You know, what's going on under that? And those are important questions to resolve too. But let's work at a higher level. You know, let's get all down in the weeds about why things are so bad when we have a choice about whether we can play in the weeds or leave it behind and move forward in a way that challenges us to grow positively instead of just put up with a situation that doesn't work. Now, of course, you might be in a terrible relationship or you might be in a terrible job. There's lots of ways that can play out. But by putting a stake in the sand and saying, you know what, I am going to be grateful, whatever that means, and then really working to find opportunities to not only just think grateful things and say, like, it's so great that doctor had me on the show today. I really appreciate that. But to say it in a way that's authentic. And maybe we've just lost our language for that. I don't remember the last time somebody said thank you to me in person, right? Mm-hmm. But if we can help put our language back, which the book kind of does, it gives us words. So we can say appreciation and gratitude and thankfulness. And there's more to it than just saying thank you. There's a whole bunch more behind that we can unpack. Isn't that a great direction to go instead of worrying about why I'm so hated or hating somebody?
Yes.
It's just making a choice towards a best practices direction versus a not so great practices direction.
Guess what's happening right now? Suddenly we have our second guest with us too. How sweet is this?
Hey,
like
Michelle.
Now we have everybody here. Michelle, we were kind of afraid we might not be able to connect. And then suddenly it's all of us together. This is awesome. So Michelle, you are, please meet Bill Pratzman. He's an author and he's also a composer. He's an amazing pianist and we're continuing our conversation with him. So you're more than welcome to just kind of like be with us and, you know, be part of the part of the conversation until, you know, we go to the next segment, which is you. So it's awesome to have you write with us. So,
thank you.
Bill, you have this Music Care, which Music Care is about an organization that offers music and personalize it in a way that, you know, you could utilize it for your mental health, for your emotions, and for motivation and all of that. And then you have your book. So I want a cheat sheet. I want to know what kind of music can we listen to have those types of, like, brings us into the space of gratitude and kindness and authenticity and integrity and respect, all of those virtues that makes us a great human being.
Well, I know you want me to tell you what music to listen to. And
yes, make it easy for us.
And it's easy, but it isn't an answer that you'd expect. So the research shows that the most powerful music for you, like for you, Dr. Shufuja, for you, Michelle, is the music you love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It might be different music, but that's completely okay. So the goal here is sort of to move out of the music that we all grew up. So our music in adolescence is kind of the music that stays with us. Generally speaking, that's kind of what we resonate. So my music is all messed up because I was a classical piano player who also played ragtime. So my music, instead of being the Beatles, which was when I should have had music, is all that. So I'm having to go back and relearn things like the Beatles and whatever. You may find yourself in a similar position. So if you've been around musical theater at all, you probably have a huge musical theater repertoire that's your music. No problem. That's cool. If you grew up, you know, in the right neighborhood, you're going to have this amazing hip-hop music that's part of you. Oh, my gosh. The music isn't really so much what matters. It's what you do with it. So we start with the music you love. And you might look at that music and say, well, so how much of this music supports me in anger? Mm-hmm. How much of it supports me in fear? How much supports me in sadness? How much in joy? And find music that can support you in each of those four primary emotions. That's usually where we start, because most people's lists, like mine, are front-loaded for something that's only 25% of what we can experience. So my list is sadness. So I'm this big classical piano player. I play all the sad music, right? That's fine. But that means I have to work to find music that supports my fear, my anger, and you'll love this, even my joy. Although I did find ragtime early on, and that's happy music. So it's all about the music you love, the music that's best for you, the music you love.
That is awesome.
That is beautiful.
Isn't it?
Just research.
yes, that is beautiful. So where can they get Amazon, right?
Oh, yeah,
they
can
get
me.
More Than Human, The Value of Cultivating the Human Spirit in Your Organization by Bill Protzman on Amazon. And then where can they find you?
I'm pretty easy to find. Practicalheartskills.com is a great place to go. But if you want to dive in and jump in and just start doing this Music Care thing and learning about it, I have an online quest. And it's fully mentored. It's gamified. It works. Quest.musiccare.net. Really hard to remember. It'll be in the show notes. You guys can find it. Quest.musiccare.net. Great place to go. There's a reason that it's set up in a kind of a ritual way and not in a psychological way or in a scientific way. Although the psychology and the science is built into the quest as well, it's set up to be more of a spiritual experience for you, if you will, even though it involves mental, emotional, physical, it's also spiritual. So quest.musiccare.net, I'll take you on a ride of your life.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for being on my show. It is awesome to have you. I love this book. I'm going to actually go over it and read it carefully. I just went through it because I wanted to be prepared, but I love it. I want to go forward with it. And then everyone, don't go anywhere. We're going to be back with Michelle Tomlinson, and we're going to see what she's up to in her acting, coaching, teaching, movie
things.
Documentary, everything that you could ever imagine. So,
yes, be right back.
Have you ever wished you could just wake up one day, reach across your nightstand, and hit the life reset button? Let's face it, the struggles and frustrations of everyday life leave millions of women and men around the globe yearning for a new way. And the new way is right here in Life Reset, the Awareness Integration Path to Create the Life You Want by Dr. Fujian Zain. You can get it now at Fujian.com or Amazon.com. Life Reset, the Awareness Integration Path to Create the Life You Want. You deserve it. Hello, I'm Dr. Fujian, and I have great news for you. I'm offering a special time-limited offer to anyone who's interested in online therapy or coaching sessions. I've developed the Awareness Integration Model, which allows in only 12 weeks to raise your self-esteem and confidence and let go of your thoughts and emotions that produce depression and anxiety for you. So call today to schedule your online session and save $600. Call me today at 818-648-2140. That's 818-648-2140. Or go to www.fujian.com.
Join the conversation every Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific for Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Dr. Fujian is a radio and TV host, international speaker, psychotherapist, life coach, and the author of Life Reset, The Awareness Path to Create the Life You Want. She brings you the latest research and interviews with experts in the field of cognitive sciences. Anyone who loves to grow and create growth for humanity gets a voice on this call-in show. Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Monday afternoons at 3 p.m. Pacific on Smart Talk KMET 1490 AM and on KMET1490AM.com.
Welcome back, everyone, to Inner Voice Show. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain, and I'm excited to have Michelle Tomlinson with us. She's an accomplished actor and has received rave reviews in several feature films that have hit festivals, theaters, and DVD releases, although she's more known for her work in indie horror feature films such as The Cellar Door, Brain Dead, and George's Intervention. Tomlinson has also enjoyed juicy roles in dramatic indie feature films such as Undercurrent, Officer Down, and Road to Open. She has also been in several web series, short films, and play. She professionally teaches and coaches actors of every age, ability, and experience level. She has several students who regularly book roles in television, features, film, commercials, and play. She quickly and adeptly recognizes the actor's essence within minutes of meeting them. I'm going to ask her if she wants a therapist in her shows. Her specialty as an acting teacher and coach is to swiftly peel away the layers of junk. I got a lot of that. And accentuate the gifts each actor brings to her or his performance. Tomlinson is also a casting director for the groundbreaking podcast Frijoles and Arroz. I hope I said it accurately. From creator James Charleston. And she's also cute. Currently directing two documentaries. That's actually what we're going to talk about. Edge with partner Lori Bowen and Rise of the Millennial with partner Kimberly Amato. And she was recently hired to direct the comedy pilot Deeply Superficial for creator Keith Allen. And oh, I'm excited about this. She also has a children's book, Growing Up May, which will be released in fall or winter of 2019 through Amazon. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here. Thank you so much.
Of course. Love to have you. Let's talk about the documentary first.
Cool. Yes. There's an order to them. Rise of the Millennial became first. And I was doing a play actually in New Mexico, and I was speaking to one of my castmates, and she popped off with something like, well, I was only six when 9/11 happened. So it's not like it's a bit. And I stopped her and I said, whoa. You were six when 9/11 happened. And she says, yeah. And for some reason, you know, we don't really look at millennials as anything other than, oh, that generation of millennials. And there's this stuff that comes, this label and these ideas that aren't really positive, right, that come when we think of millennials. But what she said, that she was only six when 9/11 happened, all of a sudden made me go, hold up. You actually don't really know what it's like to be alive without like an actual threat of something awful happening. I get goosebumps every time I talk about this, because, you know, there are generations older than ours that say, well, we had to do nuclear bomb drills of getting under the desk and all that. Well, that was probably really scary, but you didn't have nuclear bombs hitting malls and schools and Twin Towers and all of these things. Like, that was never the serious threat that the media had presented it to be at that terrifying time. Whereas the millennial generation, they've actually experienced nothing but orange alerts at airports and, you know, shootings. We just had another shooting yesterday.
Yes.
At a garlic festival.
Yeah.
Right? Like, these angry white men are running around and they're shooting everybody. Yeah. And that's to me very terrifying. And so I got into a conversation with her. Her name's Gina DeMond. And I said, dude, like, how is that for you to live during this time? Because you actually have drills in schools now that are for shooters, yeah, where everybody hides and locks doors. And there's a protocol thing now that takes place. And it's because that actually can happen. And so while we love to, you know, talk smack about millennials, we really have to look at the generation that has been left a melting planet, a time of terror, a time of gun shootings, a time of you're not sure if you can go to a movie and come back out of the theater on your feet instead of a body bag. So I instantly saw it as a documentary and phoned Kimberly Amato and said, yo, I've got this idea. I'm not sure how we're going to do this, but I think that we should create some form of a platform called Rise of like the Millennial or something. And we went back and forth with a bunch of names, and Rise of the Millennial is what we landed on, because they are having to rise up and over and through and above everything we set up for them to have as a hurdle. And so it's been really cool. And we had everybody, it's a more of an experimental thing where everybody shot their interviews on iPhones and tablets, because the millennial generation is all about the tablets, the Androids, the iPhones, and the technology. And so it was like, let's take it all the way and get it really interactive with technology. And so 98% of it is shot on some form of iPhone, Android, or tablet or iPad.
Doing this documentary, what are you finding that the millennials are experiencing at this time, understanding that the world has not been safe and they are constantly in the space of, let's say, anxiety about how the world will turn out for them or every day will turn out for them? So some people, for example, I've worked with the African-American group, which says even at the time that your world appeared to be safe in our neighborhood, that's the world that we had to go through, because our neighborhood was always, we were afraid that we were going to be shut down or, you know, something would have happened.
By the cops.
Right. Or, you, for example, you talk to people in different countries, in third world countries, and like, you know, it's sweet that the Western world appeared to be safe, but we never were anyway, because these are the issues that we had to deal with. But within a Western world that appeared that, yes, for a long time, there was an appearance of safety, mm-hmm, that we went through all the two wars in order to create safety. And part of the conversation of the United States has always been, oh, we become the big guy around the world in order to create safety. And this is, you know, our military is out there to create safety. And this message did not pan out for this group of the millennials. So not only that they're not safe, but they're not safe within their own country. This isn't about others. They're not safe within their own country from not actually immigrants, but actually their own countrymen.
Exactly.
So, yeah. So what do you think? What have you been finding in this amazing storytelling that you're getting?
Well, it's really interesting, because I went into it expecting a certain thing. I went into it, you know, Kimberly and I both thought, okay, we're going to get, you know, all these woeful tales, and we're going to have to work really hard to figure out how to turn it into some type of positive thing. And I've gotten a smattering of reactions from the millennials that we've interviewed, where some of them are like, yeah, there was one girl who had a shoe, a hold up two doors down from the retail place that she worked at the mall, like a night before she did the interview, you know, so we had that perspective, and she's saying she doesn't feel safe. And a lot of them are talking about social media actually playing a part in them not feeling safe. And then you have a few who have said, but no, you know what? I actually feel safe because I don't want to live in fear. And so you start to really kind of examine and think about, we live in the world that we believe that we live in, which is an interesting thing for these millennials to start to grasp, because they had to start grasping it so much younger than you and I ever had to, right? Of like choosing how to see things, where we have a self-proclaimed cynic in the film talking about how things have changed and nobody's ever going to fix it. We have somebody else in the film talking about how, world, I love you, and I think we're going to be okay. And we ask the millennials, what gives you hope? And a lot of them have said, my generation gives me hope. Mm-hmm. We're the ones who are going to lift ourselves out of this.
Yeah. And it's interesting. It's so interesting when you say that, because I remember my mom was in passing away, and she was really ill. And I went to Iran a couple of times just to see her and to meet with her at the age, you know, I hadn't gone there for a long time, but these years that she was sick, I kept going every year to do that. And one of the things that I also saw, it was exactly what you just said, Michelle, which is the millennial of that country, although they've been in 40 years of revolution and being put down, and really their culture has completely changed. Like the culture I was born into is so changed with the culture that is there 40 years in, you know, under the Islamic situation. But you really got the millennials hopeful in the way that they were going to figure out how to create who they were, even within a corrupt system, or even within a system that just was bashing them. So I really sense what you're saying on both ground, on both countries that I live in and then I visit it, and how much this group is really the hope that they're going to do something about this. This isn't just a passive concept. But I think that sometimes when reality is of just kind of all is well, then people become passive. And sometimes we do need, you know, something to brings us into a place of, I'm going to survive. I'm going to make it. And that is what brings people together to create that.
Absolutely. You know, if you look at, without getting too political, if you look at the divided lines of our country right now, one beautiful thing that I have experienced, seen, felt, is people doing this, mm-hmm. and trying to rise together in peace and love, and trying to figure things out and in kindness. And that's really refreshing, because you're right, it does take a thing to help people come together, versus people aren't just going to kumbaya for no good reason. You know, yeah. That's not the human nature, sadly.
Where and how, when can we see the rise of the millennial?
I am in my fourth or fifth draft of the EDL right now. Lori Bowen is editing that, and Kimberly Amato and I are fine-tuning it. So hopefully we'll be done within the next few months, and then we're going to hit the festival circuit with Yay. It. Just see what happens. Yeah.
Before we end, I really want us to talk also about Growing Up May, children's book, which is a story about a little duck named May, who gets separated from her mom and siblings, and her journey encompasses friendship and courage and doing what's right, and showcases the bond of love between a mother and her daughter. So tell us about what got you to want to write this book, and, you know, what does it offer the readers? Little ones.
This book excites me. Oh my God. I was super pregnant at the Van Nuys Japanese Gardens in LA. And I was sitting there watching these butterflies butterflies going from, you know, flower to flower, plant to plant, and doing the things. And there's ducks there and all these things. And so, and there were some baby ducks, and I just sat there and just kind of meditated on what I was experiencing and just being really super, super present. Pregnancy was an incredibly spiritual journey for me. And I just really learned how to be present inside my body for the first time, I think, ever. Wow. And all of a sudden, in a flash, I just got the concept of this story.
Yeah.
I thought, oh my God, I wonder if I could actually write that, because I've never felt like I was a writer. I was always told by others that I'm not creative enough and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so I really didn't think I could do it. And then I just kind of sat down one day and wrote an outline for it. And then I talked to my mom and I said, you're a brilliant artist. Would you be willing to illustrate my book? I'll give you the outline and you start coming up with some watercolors, because she's a brilliant, brilliant watercolor artist. So she started fiddling with it. We found the duck, you know, and then I shaped the story, the outline of the story, even stronger around my mom's paintings, because my mom's paintings brought it to this exquisite, adorable level. And it's a very inspiring, sweet story about the journey of life. And we hit bumps in the road, but at the end of the day, who's got your back? Your mom.
Beautiful. Michelle, where can people find you?
Anywhere. My website is michelletomlinson.net. Not com, but net. So michelletomlinson.net will take you to everything. And Facebook, Instagram, Twitter.
Yeah. And say just one thing about the podcast so they can also find you on the podcast.
About the frijoles y arroz,
mm-hmm.
Let's End Sexual Assault. Frijoles y arroz is available to subscribe to on Buzzsprout, and it also has its own Instagram and I don't think Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, Pinterest, social media accounts. But that is all about ending sexual assault. It's amazing.
Wow, I got to listen to it. It's amazing, Michelle. You're doing so many things, multitasking, and every one of them is amazing. So it was great having you on the show. Thank you. For everyone who's out there listening and watching, guys, create an amazing, amazing day and a week for yourself and everyone around you. Until next week, bye-bye.